stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman reporting. The setting will be an economic summit. The topic is likely to be Russia and Ukraine. U.S. President Barack Obama is preparing to head to the G7 summit in Germany Sunday, where he will attempt to rally his G7 partners to extend sanctions on Russia for its continuing involvement in Ukraine. Although the formal purpose of the G7 talks is trade, the issues of Ukraine and the strategy against the Islamic State group are expected to dominate the discussions.
Talks at this resort in the German Alps are to open Sunday with discussions on economic issues and climate change, but G7 leaders are also hoping to hear from President Obama on plans for moving forward on Ukraine and the Islamic State group. Some G7 nations are participating in allied bombing raids against the Islamic State group, and the fighters' recent capture of Ramadi in Iraq has left many wondering whether Mr. Obama's strategy is working. The biggest issue, however, is Russia, excluded from the meeting for a second year. There are questions here about the U.S. leader's approach to Russia, one that White House officials, including spokesman Josh Earnest, acknowledge has not changed Vladimir Putin's behavior in Ukraine.
The economic pressure that's been applied to Russia has not yet resulted in President Putin changing his strategic calculus.
Luis Ramirez, near the site of the G7 summit in Garmisch, Germany.
A suspected U.S. drone strike Saturday in Pakistan's once militant-dominated North Waziristan border region killed at least 9 suspected militants. Local media quoted security officials as saying that an unmanned aircraft fired 2 missiles on a compound in the remote Shawal Valley, and those killed were linked to Afghanistan's neighboring Taliban insurgencies. This is VOA News. The death toll in central China from a capsized tourist ship on the Yangtze River rose to 396 Saturday as recovery teams continue to search the vessel. Most of the victims have been recovered since the ship was upright Friday. Only 14 people have been rescued since the Eastern Star went down in severe weather late Monday. The ship's captain and chief engineer, who survived the sinking, are being questioned by police. China's transportation ministry says 456 people were on board, leaving nearly 50 people still missing. Pope Francis made an historic visit to the Bosnian capital of Sarajevo Saturday, calling for sustainable reconciliation 2 decades after the Bosnian War. During his one-day visit, Francis performed mass before tens of thousands in the country, which broke away from Yugoslavia, triggering a civil war that killed thousands of people. In his message to the followers, the Pope urged them to have the courage of forgiveness. A court in Egypt has overturned a ruling by another court that had declared Gaza's ruling Hamas faction a terrorist organization. There was no immediate reaction Saturday from the Egyptian government or Hamas. An Egyptian court had labeled Hamas a terrorist group in February, 1 month after a similar ruling against its military wing. Relations between the Egyptian government and Hamas have deteriorated in recent months after the Egyptian army began sealing off remaining tunnels between Gaza and the northern Sinai. Many Egyptian analysts see Hamas as an offshoot of the now outlawed Muslim Brotherhood, dating back to Egypt's rule over Gaza from 1948 to 1967. Egypt had close ties with Hamas under ousted Islamist president Mohamed Morsi, who ran the country from June of 2012 to July of 2013. An American pharaoh will seek to become the first horse in nearly 40 years to win the coveted Triple Crown when he competes in the Belmont Stakes later Saturday. The colt with jockey Victor Espinosa aboard will take on 7 rivals at the 2.414-kilometer Belmont Track in Elmont, New York. That's outside New York City. It is the longest track of the 3 Triple Crown jewels, the Kentucky Derby, the Preakness, and the Belmont Stakes, and it is dubbed the Test of Champions because of its demanding distance. American Pharoah, which won the Kentucky Derby and the Preakness handily, is the 14th horse with a Triple Crown chance since affirmed, with Steve Cawthon aboard, won in 1978. The owner of the 3-year-old horse, Ahmed Zayed, thinks his colt could end the long drought. Look at him, Zayed told reporters. This will be his 4th race in 8 weeks. That usually takes a toll, but he's coming into the race the best he can be.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
We filed a case with the Supreme Court, demanding the Supreme Court to stop Parliament from any attempt to change the constitution, especially on the Article 101.
Rwandan opposition party petitions the Supreme Court to prevent Parliament from amending the constitution that would allow President Paul Kagame to seek a third term.
I think the judicial system has been compromised given the magnitude of the case. The name of the deceased has not been disclosed, and we think that the sentence is too lenient.
Zimbabwean First Lady's son is found guilty of killing a pedestrian. We'll have a report.
I want to say a big thank you to all of you. Thank you for coming on behalf of One Vision, on behalf of the Smart Alliance. I want to say thank you, thank you, thank you.
And the Sierra Leonean Ebola burial team receives international recognition for their hard work during the outbreak of the epidemic. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Rwandan opposition Green Party has petitioned the Supreme Court to prevent Parliament from moving ahead with plans to amend the constitution to pave way for President Paul Kagame to seek re-election. Adopted in 2003, the Rwanda constitution stipulates only two presidential term limits. Frank Habineza, chairman of the Green Party, told me that it will be illegal for Parliament to change the constitution.
We filed a case with the Supreme Court, demanding the Supreme Court to stop Parliament from any attempt to change the constitution, especially on the Article 101, which concerns the lifting of presidential term limits. We've been seeing that the momentum has been gaining, and we recently had written to the Parliament requesting them not to change the constitution, but we saw that more people are coming to the Parliament. And these people coming, it's not in anywhere written that a lot of people should call for any change the constitution. Because the law mentions that it should be the President of the Republic after the confirmation of the Cabinet or the Parliament, either the Senate or the Chamber of Deputies. They are the ones who can propose the change of the Constitution. But now things are being done backwards, because it's the people now saying they want to change the Constitution, which is not legal anyway.
Some people are saying that your petition will not see the light of day, and that this will not be effective because you have over 2 million people who want the president to seek re-election. What do you say to that?
First, we as we say that there's no law that guarantees that people can ask for any change of the constitution. So it doesn't matter whether they are 2 million or 4 million. It's just their sentiment. Just get their wishes. That's not illegal. What is illegal, though, is that the president can request for the change of the constitution, but not on the articles which are in terms of like 101 or 193. Those ones cannot be changed. So we think that the Supreme Court, which is also in charge of protecting the constitution, will give value to our petition and should order the parliament to stop any attempt to change the constitution, but also help in giving a proper interpretation to those two articles so that all confusion can be taken away.
What do you say to your critics who say that the moves you are making are unlikely to succeed and that you are actually being paid by the government to make such moves? What do you say to that?
That's completely baseless, because if we don't make any contribution, people say, oh, now you are keeping quiet. The government has threatened you to keep quiet or they have paid you. And if you act, and people, oh, well, you know, so people can always say this and that. And the reason is that because Rwanda is a country where we still have challenges with the freedom of speech and the freedom of expression. So the few of us who manage to be strong enough to challenge the actions of the government, people, of course, they get concerned, because, of course, we have also had circumstances in the past where some of our members have had problems. So people are always wondering what is going on, but because of the atmosphere that has been there. But we know that democracy is a struggle. We have to struggle for it. We have to demand for it. No one is going to give you anything on a silver plate. So it's a process which has started and will continue to make Rwanda a better country.
So when will the Supreme Court begin hearing your case?
At the moment, we don't know, but it was filed on Wednesday, and we have an official record that has received. Now we wait to hear from the Supreme Court if they're going to receive it and put it on the agenda. We shall know perhaps soon, because this is an urgent case.
Frank Habineza is the chairman of the Rwandan Opposition Green Party. He spoke with me from the capital, Kigali. This week, the Nigerian Senate approved President Muhammadu Buhari's request to appoint 15 special advisers for his administration. The Senate took the decision after Mr. Buhari's letter was read out to the lawmakers. To learn more, I reached Senator Maina Maji Lawal to give us the details about the Senate's approval of President Buhari's advisers.
Well, the Senate was very happy to have received President Buhari's request for 15 special advisors and approved all of them. That is his, that is the constitutional limit allowed the president for number of advisors. And for us, we just performed one of our constitutional duties.
Well, some people are saying previous presidents have had more. Why is this different?
Number one, that is his request. It is not the Senate pegging it at 15. And the 15, I think, is also the constitutional provision. I remember in 1999, President Obasanjo requested for 15, and the 15 was approved for him. But presidents, just like many chief executives, have many ways of going around expanding political patronages and favors, and also recruiting aid. So you have senior special assistants, special assistants, and all sorts of things that are not exactly in the Constitution, but within the executive powers to explore. So if previous presidents have, you have had much more than 15, it is these other openings they exploited. But as far as advisors are concerned, they had 15, and it was 15 that was approved.
Has the Senate received any signal of possible cabinet minister confirmation that the president will soon present to you?
No. The Senate is ready to receive communication from the president, as you have seen. If he had sent ministers, the Senate would have treated it exactly the way advisors are treated. You know, in the case of advisors, you do not submit names of individuals. He will make a request for approval for the number of advisors. In the case of ministers, names will be coming. The screening of the individuals will take place, and it is a whole process. Therefore, I do not think the current Senate will receive ministers, but the next Senate that is coming on board on the 9th, as soon as the presiding officers are elected and properly constituted, I believe you will expeditiously send his request for confirmation of ministers. But that is up to the president. Once the president communicates, either with this current Senate or the next Senate that will be in place on the 9th, either way, I do not think confirmation of his ministers will be any problem.
Before the old Senate time elapses, for the new ones to be sworn in, what should Nigerians expect from the Senate?
Nigerians should expect the next Senate will be APC-led Senate, and Nigerians should expect the Senate to be very supportive of Mr. President's programs, and the expectations placed on the president is the same degree of expectations that will be placed on the Senate. We expect that it will be very vibrant, very active, and very eager to bring about the change that the Nigerian people have very clearly and very strongly indicated in the strength of mandate they gave to General Buhari and candidates of the APC.
Maina Maji Lawal is a Nigerian senator. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Zimbabwean First Lady Grace Mugabe's son, Russell Gorereza, has been found guilty of killing a pedestrian a few months ago. For VOA, Thomas Chiripazi has details from the capital, Harare.
Russell Gorereza, the son of Mrs. Mugabe and her first husband, former Air Force of Zimbabwe Intelligence Officer Wing Commander Stanley Gorereza, was arraigned before a Harare magistrate today to face charges of culpable homicide. Prosecutor Venenzia Mutake told the court that on February 23 this year, Russell was driving his BMW vehicle registration number ACO0266 along Samora Machel Avenue in Harare Central Business District when he knocked down an unidentified pedestrian who died on the spot. The state attorney said the first lady's 31-year-old son was overspeeding, resulting in him failing to apply emergency brakes to avoid the accident. Gorereza, who spent a night at Roseville police station, pleaded guilty to the charge and immediately apologized for causing the death of the unidentified pedestrian. Magistrate Vakai Chikwekwe then ordered Gorereza to pay a fine of $800 or alternatively spend 2 months in jail. The magistrate said he was lenient on the accused person because he was never convicted before, adding that he was the custodian of his minor child following his divorce with his wife. After the magistrate gave his ruling, Gorereza rose again to apologize for the unidentified person's death. Coalition Against Corruption Director Terry Mutranga said the non-disclosure of the deceased person's identity in court is suspicious.
I think the judicial system has been compromised given the magnitude of the case. The name of the deceased has not been disclosed, and we think that the sentence is too lenient.
Mutranga said this puts a dent on the first family's image.
Obviously, the image has been dented. If it was something that was in a transparent manner, the name of the deceased was supposed to be said in court.
This is almost the first time in the history of culpable homicide cases that a deceased person under such road accidents has not been identified. Police spokesperson Senior Assistant Commissioner Charity Charamba was not reachable for comment. Russell Gorereza made headlines recently when he was allegedly refusing to pay workers at his Toro's gold mine in Kadoma. He also made headlines for the wrong reasons when he was involved in several violent incidents at drinking joints. From Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
A multinational chain of primary schools has raised controversy because of its for-profit model of education targeting the poor. But in Kenyan slums where public schools are woefully inadequate, private non-formal schools say they are the only way for children to learn. For VOA, Hilary Hula has more from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
Meat from cattle.
Beef is meat from cattle. Can you say beef, meat from cattle?
The walls are made of rusty corrugated metal. The leaky roof lets in the rain, and the muddy alley outside is strewn with trash. But the 20 or so children packed into the small room don't seem to mind. They're focused on learning English. This non-formal school sits in Mathare, a Nairobi slum of around 500,000 people. There are only 4 public schools in Mathare, not nearly enough to accommodate all the potential students. Even for those who do make it in, says head teacher Richard Zolare, the education is poor.
They don't have enough rooms, and then even the teacher-pupil ratio is actually very imbalanced. Having like more than 100 children in a class makes it so hard for a teacher to have close relationships with their kids.
Olari's school isn't free. Children pay around $5 a month to attend. But the slum has around 120 non-formal schools like his. They serve an important role, he says, stepping in to teach the thousands of children who otherwise wouldn't be in school at all.
We teach, we use the same syllabus, the same curriculum, but we are non-formal in the physical structures. Otherwise, we do exactly what is done in the public schools.
Such for-profit schools came to attention recently when the World Bank invested $10 million in Bridge International Academies, a multinational chain of low-fee private schools. Bridge is also backed by Microsoft founder Bill Gates and Facebook creator Mark Zuckerberg. Bridge says its for-profit model not only provides an opportunity for children who would otherwise be left out of school, but also gets better results. Such schools complement the public system, the company says, and it hopes to eventually be considered for public funding itself. But Sylvia Mbataru of Haki Jami, one of a group of civil society organizations critical of Bridge, is bothered by the idea of a separate schooling system for the poor. She says this funding should instead go into making sure everyone can be educated at the same schools for free.
They have all this money to go and invest in a private education system where kids and poor parents are forced to dig in their pockets to access education. Why is it that this money cannot be channeled to governments and support them to make education freely accessible to everyone?
If you're living in the slums, she says, even a few dollars a month can be a lot of money. Janet Awar spends her days selling fried chapatis on the roadside in Mathare. She has four children in school.
Me, I am working outside there. I'm working very hard to get that money. I'm struggling for school fee, rent, food.
Nearly all her income goes into school fees, she says. And she often has to borrow money for food. But two of Awar's children are in a public school, and despite a 2003 law making primary education free, she says she has to pay for that, too. Community organizer Bernard Ocheng says that in Mathare, public schools often charge even higher fees than private ones.
Government is saying the school is free, but in real sense, school is not free. School is free in the TV or in the media. But when you go in the school, you will realize that there is no free education there.
As long as the government fails to educate all Kenyan children for free, private schools will continue to exist, says Ocheng. But whether the World Bank should be pouring money into them, he adds, is another matter entirely. Hilary Hewler for VOA News, Nairobi.
Still in East Africa, the fight against ivory trafficking, police in Kenya have arrested several people, including a Kenyan tycoon and his sons, in connection to ivory seizures in Asia. The ivory was allegedly shipped from the port of Mombasa to Asia. Kathleen Garrigan is the spokesperson for the Africa Wildlife Foundation, a leading conservation organization. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached her in Washington for details of the arrests.
There have been a couple of arrests leading up to this, people involved with the shipment, you know, along the sort of supply chain. But mostly it's been lower-level people, or they've been relieved of their duties pending the investigation. But with the arrest of this tycoon in Mombasa, Abdurrahman Mohamed Sheikh, and then of his two sons, that is sort of the first high-level arrest that we've had with regard to he's being linked to two seizures of illegal ivory in Asia, one in Thailand and one in Singapore, allegedly. So, and there have been several arrests along the way, but this is the first sort of high-level person that's been arrested.
Do we know what quantities were involved?
The ivory that was seized, the Mombasa port in Kenya is known as a transit hub for illegal ivory. So the shipments left that port. One was transiting through Thailand on its way to Laos. When it was discovered by Thai authorities, Thai customs officials. The other one was also, the final destination was Laos, but it was transiting through Singapore. And so authorities in Singapore received a tip-off from agents in Kenya that this shipment was on its way, and they suspected that there was illegal ivory on one of the containers, and the Singapore officials discovered it and seized the ivory.
Kenya is not known for strong wildlife crime prevention or control. And this seems to have been a coordinated operation involving many agencies. Do we see some improvement in the prevention of this smuggling of ivory?
I think definitely, and especially with this kind of arrest and with this type of investigation. I mean, as you pointed out, a lot of different agencies within the Kenyan government were involved and working together to bring about this arrest. They did make a few arrests, but it didn't end there. They continued to investigate and work among the various agencies, sharing information, communicating well, working with the Regional Bureau of Interpol. And because of that whole-of-government approach, they were able to eventually tie, or what they believe, tie that ivory to this person in Mombasa. So that shows a significant improvement in following an investigation sort of to its zenith with the arrest of the, you know, what presumably is the kingpin behind this ivory trafficking operation.
Your organization, the African Wildlife Foundation, has been trying to strengthen laws regarding this issue. Are you seeing some success with this kind of arrest?
We are. I mean, we this is very, very encouraging. I think, you know, prior to this, we were seeing a lot more arrests, but they tended to be lower-level people and certainly a lot of poachers. But, of course, you know, you can take one poacher out of the field, but there's 10 more behind him. So this is one of the first indications that the Kenyan government is going after even the well-connected and the wealthy, the people who are at the top of the food chain. And that signals a shift, I think, in the way that they're approaching this problem, that they're not just going to go after the people at the bottom. They're going to go after the people at the top as well. So I think it's a very encouraging sign. I think it's a good example for other countries, not just in Africa, but around the world, about how, in order to crack down on this trade, you have to have all these different levers in the government working together.
Kathleen Garrigan is the spokesperson for the Africa Wildlife Foundation, a leading conservation organization. She spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from Washington. People on the teams that buried Ebola victims in Sierra Leone have been stigmatized and shunned because of their connection to the deadly virus. But abroad, the burial teams are being recognized and praised. Teams across the country have received an international humanitarian award which recognizes their contribution to stopping the spread of Ebola. For VOA, Nina DeVries has more from the capital, Freetown.
Masere Kamara is one of 800 burial team members in Sierra Leone honored with the award called the Bond International Humanitarian Award. The award, which is given by a British-based organization for development, recognizes unsung heroes. Speaking in her Mende language, Kamara says she became a burial team member because she wanted to protect other women from the virus, which is highly contagious right after an Ebola victim dies. Kamara is also an Ebola survivor and one of the first women to join a burial team.
I want to say a big thank you to all of you. Thank you for coming on behalf of One Vision, on behalf of the Smart Alliance. I want to say thank you, thank you, thank you.
Sidi Kanu is another team member. He works in the Bo District, a southern part of Sierra Leone. The area hasn't had an Ebola case since January.
Oh, I feel very proud. I feel happy.
Kanu says there are still challenges. Some people in remote places are still in denial that the virus is real. And then there's a rainy season, which has kicked in. The World Health Organization has also raised concerns about this and the logistics of quickly reaching a burial team when an Ebola patient dies.
We find it very difficult. We get stuck and then, you know, you have to walk the rains, and then maybe where you get stuck, there is no village around there for help. So sometimes you have to walk for another 2-3 miles to get people to help you. And at times there are no coverage, so you cannot make a phone call for a vehicle to come and rescue.
Although it can be tricky, there is support. The burial teams are a consortium made up of three international aid groups. Together, they've trained the workers to perform safe and dignified burials across the country. Now, all burials, whether Ebola cases or not, have to be done by burial teams. Grace Cargbo is a burial team manager for World Vision, another partner of the consortium. She was in London earlier this week to receive the award on behalf of the teams. Life isn't easy for many who are being shunned, sometimes even by their own families.
They have sacrificed so much, their lives, their safety, their health, to serve as burial team members. And I think they deserve this recognition. And I believe it will influence the reversing of the stigmatization that they face. So it's really huge for the burial teams and for all of us.
To date, just over 11,000 people have died in West Africa from the virus. Nina DeVries for VOA News, Freetown, Sierra Leone.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of the Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our African collection of music from the continent. Then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. Well, right now it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy what we have for you today. Woman go day.
Okay. Anything where you dey do, my brother. Woman go day.
For sure.
I say woman go day. If you invite purpose to your party, then go ask you whether woman go day.
For sure.
She be woman go day. Shall a woman they make you the
kiddy one day?
Say kiddy one day.
Still emphasizing, just the analyzing, hypnotizing is the hidden strength of a woman. Try looking at you, not getting good. You go make plenty sense if you roll my boat. Every come baby, oh, hey.
When a woman go there,
for sure.
She be woman go there. Shall a woman they make you the
kitty one day, the kitty one day, the kitty one.
A woman they make you the
kitty one day,
the kitty one day,
the kitty one.
Shall a woman they make you
the kitty one day,
the kitty one day,
the kitty one.
Shall a woman they make you the kitty one day,
the kitty one day,
the kitty one. The woman go there, it's more begin they cry. The woman go there, even got they put down yo. The woman be say man go succeed, he go fail. Underestimate my power. As for my beautiful lady, me I go love you well, well. I go do you sorry, sorry. Make we they go. I'm gonna jam my paro. Cause without you, baby, man, I'm so lonely. Yeah. Anything where you they do, my brother, yeah. Woman go there.
For sure.
I say woman go there. If you invite purpose to your party, then go ask you whether woman go there.
For sure.
She be woman.
Baby, let's
this fresh song loving. The way you moving your body from left and right to somebody. Now they pump, look at them and them look at you. Everybody just feeling you, mama, mama, just feeling you. Tell them, mama, 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 you go like to the balaga. Chop in the banana, oh, come on, chop in the banana, ah, banana, ah. To the right, yo, eh. To the right, yo, eh. Yo, to the right, yo, eh. Take it, no, 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 no. Take it, no, 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 no. I let the way you control. Lose the control, no, 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 no.
But anytime when she come around, she get this feeling where they do me like fever. And when she dance with my messy boo, he dey be me like Senna for Fana. Me like how she play the best line, it makes me sing ooh la la la. The way she the way she that, it makes me sing ooh la la la. Oh yeah. When mommy come back, she a duff. Daddy come to me a cross. And when they ask me, it was me. That's what me talk say. I don't like this shirt, but your body. But she no say, my mama no like them. I don't want this shirt but your body. Waka. Cause you know say my papa no like them. Waka. It's an absolute. Oh na 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 na. Oh na 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 na. Oh na 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 na. Oh na 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 na.
Ale pepe busenda mambo bache matulaka damba tema wanya magoro. Sile beba ni mabani.
Me like how she play the bass line. It makes me sing ooh la la la. The way she the way she that. It makes me sing ooh la la la. Oh yeah. When mommy come back, she a jump. Daddy come to me a cross. And when they ask me, it was me. That's what me talk say. I don't like this shirt, but your body.
Control, control. I have to be dancing. Shimbala, shimbala.
walk a shit again. The way that she boo boo gaga, oh, you got to feel it, man. Don't need to go 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 before she dance, yo. When you make I flex your body, when you make me rock the go, rock the go. Oh, yeah, make me rock the go.
She won't make rosé, over by me lolé. Say if you want to go play. This one at home and go bay. Bet. Hey. Hop, 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 right away, saw your face, I saw your face, yeah. As I move closer, yeah, this is that you appreciate. Wait. Hey, up. Open up. Ah, hold up.
Yes.
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. It's now time for commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It's always a pleasure that every week I have the opportunity to share with the audience of the Voice of America my reflections on U.S. policy towards the United States. Simultaneously, I pay attention to African opinions on and attitudes towards these United States. Today, briefly, I would like to focus on a number of points with regard to recent trends. Testimonies made by U.S. leaders of diplomacy to the members of Congress emphasize some key points with regard to America's role in African security. Those who pay close attention to events in Africa are mindful of a number of points. One is terrorism. And we see that in Mali, we see that in Somalia, in East Africa, and we see that in North Africa. So those who are concerned about U.S. policy in Africa with respect to security are very mindful of the fact that the Boko Haram phenomenon is still alive. During the Nigerian elections, many people talk about what the Jonathan administration could do to settle scores with Boko Haram. Apparently, the monster called Boko Haram is still alive. Many people thought that when you have a change of leadership, the Boko Haram would disappear. It doesn't look like that. This makes it imperative for people who are interested in U.S. policy in Africa to go back to square one and look at security. This leads you immediately to how security is very much linked to development. What the U.S. leadership and the African leadership must begin to do is to go back to square one. The biggest issue of Kwame Nkrumah when Ghana became independent: how are we going to deal with state building and nation building? Fortunately, a number of African countries have made significant progress in that direction. Tanzanians still use Swahili to unite them, not so in many African countries. Even in Somalia or Ethiopia, in Somalia, we have a language that could have been elevated to scientific level so that it become as effective for them as Chinese and Japanese, Koreans and Vietnamese use their languages to get scientific and technological know-how. The same thing could have happened with Amhara with respect to Ethiopia. The Sudanese had Arabic, but because they have a north-south split, you do have a large number of Southern Sudanese who can speak their own form of Arabic because you have variation among Arabic speakers. But you see, because the Arabs were never united sufficiently, like other groups, they couldn't have a standardized Arabic local levels of their different communities. So if you go back to U.S. policy towards Africa, the whole question of language is beginning to come back to political development in Africa. Kwame Nkrumah tried to grapple with the language issue in Ghana. And of course, in the Ghanaian situation, English went side by side with the other languages, like Twi, Fanti speakers, even the Fra-Fra to the north, and many of the other minorities. But if you come to the south, you have the people who are Ga speakers or Ewe speakers dealing with their languages. So if you go back to Senegal, you can see U.S. policy has affected Senegalese society to the point that Senegalese, they spoke Wolof with most scholars in France who study languages in French Africa will tell you that Wolof was widely spoken by Senegalese. So it went side by side with French and people like Leopold Senghor in terms of cultural policies in dealing with Americans, try to promote English indirectly by linking Senegal with the African-Americans and the Afro-Caribbeans. By accident, Senegalese migration into the United States has empowered English to the point that there are now large number of Senegalese. By some estimates, maybe more Senegalese speak English than the Italians because they are much larger. There is a large number of Senegalese coming to the United States. So if you look at U.S. policy towards Africa with regard to security, you can see how U.S. policy in Africa is not only going to affect security policies, it has language policies. This is one of the reasons why the African leaders should begin to look at agriculture, cultural policies, security policies, and economic development. They have to go together. So this should be an issue for the next summit between President Obama and the African leaders before he leaves office. Because the African leaders now should begin to work out a new coalition with regard to security. These words are loud in the testimonies of many of the State Department officials who are trying to tell Congress to finance their activities in Africa with regard to security and how American know-how and American logistic powers could make a big difference. The third point I want to emphasize here is how, when you look at U.S. policy towards Africa, every week, every month, and every year, you have to pay close attention to the basic issue, state building, nation building. If the societies are not able to develop nations so that people can have elections, and they begin to learn from the experiences of other countries, one lesson from the United States is term limits for presidents, something that is still new in Africa, term limits, because many of the African leaders try to see they are going to be in and out of office, but they still stay on. That's why the embarrassment of U-turn for the president of Uganda, who told his people when they came to power in the 80s that people like to stay in power too long. Unfortunately, since he came to power, he is still going through this U-turn. We see that in Burundi, we saw that in Nigeria with Obasanjo, we saw that with Ablaye Wada in Senegal. So term limits become very important for the presidencies. Eventually, the Africans and the rest of the world will have to recognize that politics is not something you stay there for life. The bottom line is the people who vote you are powerful, not you, the individual. And that's the way it is, I say, for U.S. policy towards Africa and African opinions on and attitudes toward the United States. And that's the way it is this week.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America and from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Tiang Wang. We say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, it is in the house of a coward that people gather and point to the tomb of yesterday's warrior. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Though it faces a food security crisis that threatens more than 4 million of its people, the government of South Sudan took the extraordinary and regrettable step of expelling the top United Nations official working there to help address the emergency. The government of South Sudan indicated that the decision to expel UN humanitarian coordinator Toby Lanzer came after remarks Lanzer made in a television interview regarding the gravity of the humanitarian crisis facing the country. The humanitarian crisis is the direct result of ongoing fighting between the government and opposition forces that began in December 2013, when a political split between President Salva Kiir and his former Vice President Riek Machar erupted into violence. The United States condemns the decision to expel Mr. Lanzer. The action is an affront to the international community working to bring peace and stability to South Sudan. It also demonstrates a callous disregard for the suffering of the South Sudanese people. The government's priority should be bringing an end to the violence that has already displaced more than 2 million of its citizens, half a million of whom are now refugees in neighboring countries, and left 4.6 million facing extreme, life-threatening hunger. The United States has contributed more than $1.1 billion in emergency aid to house, feed, and provide medical services for the people of South Sudan, as well as improve water, sanitation, and hygiene services. We strongly support the work of the UN mission in South Sudan and that of Mr. Lanzer, who has been instrumental in addressing the dire humanitarian needs of conflict-affected communities and has been a strong partner and advocate for vulnerable populations in South Sudan. We join UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and other governments in calling on the government of South Sudan to reverse its decision and to cooperate fully with all United Nations entities present in South Sudan, as well as other international organizations working on behalf of the South Sudanese people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.